All right, this is Matt and Kyle, and we are here with Ron Jeffries of Jolly Pumpkin Artisan Ales in Dexter, Michigan. He's the owner, brewmaster, captain, whatever you want to call it, runs the joint out there. Thanks for talking to us today, Ron.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. First question I wanted to ask you is just how you personally got started in brewing beer.
Well, it's a long story, and it's not a very exciting story, unfortunately, but beer is just something that I like a lot. I've always enjoyed beer as long as I can remember, and I never really thought about brewing beer until one day, many years ago, I went to a friend's house, and he happened to be homebrewing, and something kind of either clicked or snapped in my head, depending on which way you want to look at it, and I called him the next day, and I said, let's open a brewery. He said, you don't, what do you, he just laughed. He's like, you don't know anything about brewing beer. You don't, why do you want to open a brewery? And I didn't know anything about beer. So I started learning, I mean, other than drinking it, and more about brewing beer. And the more I learned, the more it really became clear it was something that I really wanted to do and was, I had a good background for it, for brewing, especially in a small brewery. I knew I wanted to work in small breweries and craft breweries, microbreweries. So I started studying brewing science, and about 4 years after that, I was able to get hired in a small brewery and kind of never looked back.
And just worked your way up. And was the ultimate goal always to open your own place?
Exactly. The ultimate goal was always to open my own place. And so I never, people always ask, or often ask, were you a home brewer and you decided to get serious? Well, I wasn't. I just, one morning, woke up and decided I wanted to run a brewery and brew beer for a living, and then worked backwards from there.
Excellent. And where, if I can ask, did you get the formal education, the brewing science?
Well, when I started studying brewing science, I had a young family, and so I was working a couple of jobs, and we didn't really have the opportunity to go to Edinburgh or someplace like that go to the University of Brewing and Distilling, anything exciting. And I couldn't take off work long enough to do a shorter program at UC Davis or anything like that. So I was also in graduate school at the time and studying towards a Master's of Science. So I basically bought all the scientific brewing texts and started reading them and changed the focus of my master's program to look at issues of craft brewing, microbrewing, issues of waste and efficiency and things along those lines, and sort of an environmental process program, if you will.
Okay.
And was about halfway through that degree when I was hired to work in a brewery.
And so you just sort of...
So I kind of custom designed my own program that had to do with breweries and fit it into the university program that I happened to be at. And sort of a little bit of an irony side note on that is I was years later, working at a brewery, and the dean, not the dean of the school when I was there, but the dean now came in. And of course, they asked the question, how did you start brewing? And I explained. And of course, as you did, where did your formal education? So I just sort of explained. And he said, what university was that? And I told him, and he said, oh, we would never let you do that now.
Well, you came in right in time then.
Yeah, I got in under the wire, I guess, on that one. So mostly it's been, self-study and school of scraped knuckles and dirty knees, I guess.
Excellent. And so what would you say is the overall concept for Jolly Pumpkin Ales for people who may not be familiar with your brewery?
The overall concept of Jolly Pumpkin? Well, my wife Lori and I got to the point where we were really looking at the possibility of being able to open this brewery up. It was years of brewing for other people, and we had had the business plan completed for a while, and we were sitting in the backyard drinking beer, and we were drinking some sour Flemish red and brown ales, and I said, if I could just make beer like this for the rest of my life, that would be pretty cool. And it kind of spiraled out of control from there. So when we opened, we decided that we would do 100% oak-aged, sour, and wild beer. And we are the only brewery in the states that's doing that. As far as I know, the only brewery that ages 100% of its beer in oak with naturally occurring wild yeast and souring bacteria. And we branched out a little bit. We don't just do a sour Flanders red or a sour Flanders brown. We do many different styles. Most of them start with some sort of Belgian influence or inspiration, and we put our own sort of spin on those recipes and ideas and age them in oak and sell them.
Yeah. And so I wanted to ask you about all of that. So you say it's all wild fermentation. Do you add any yeast, or is it all just open fermented and you just let the wild stuff go crazy?
Well, actually, it is very much in the Flanders Red tradition. We have a primary fermentation in open stainless steel tanks. They're flat bottom tanks with an open top, but the primary fermentation is with a standard, if you will, brewing yeast. We use mostly Belgian strains. We do bring in some different strains for some of our seasonals and specials that are not Belgian strains, but we mostly work with Belgian strains. And the beer at that point is very clean, happy, friendly, run-of-the-mill, everyday Belgian beer. It's often a misconception among people that anything that's fermented in an open fermenter is wild and sour. It's completely not the case. A lot of traditional British breweries use open fermenters. Pilsner Urquell used open fermenters relatively recently in the big scheme of things. In fact, if you take the tour at their brewery and you go down in the cellars, it's only served in the guest area on the tours, but they still have their old wooden fermenters, open fermenters that they make beer in. So the beer starts out as happy, friendly, everyday Belgian beer, and it's really only in the oak that you have the souring bacteria and the wild yeast, and that's where the fun and the magic really starts to happen.
Okay, and so then it's just whatever sort of yeast and bacteria are sort of in the air in Michigan, or do you go out of your way? I know that W yeast and some other cell like bacterial, you know,
right,
collections of stuff.
It was important to us, and this was a little bit of a leap of faith because we didn't know when we started if the wild yeast. No one was doing this in the U.S. and there's not a lot of information on Brettanomyces and lambics or anything like that out there, at least available to me that I could find. And so we were taking a little bit of a leap of faith. Would the wild yeast and sour bacteria in Dexter create tasty beer? We didn't know, and so but fortunately it seems to have worked out okay. We don't buy store-bought cultures of bacteria or wild yeast. It's just what has shown up in the wood. Occasionally we buy a lot of different barrels, and some of them are used wine barrels, and occasionally they show up with their own Brettanomyces in them, but other than that it's really just what has shown up spontaneously from the air in Dexter.
Okay.
Where do you tend to get all your wood? You said some of them are from other wineries and things like that.
We have a few wine barrels. Yeah, some barrels that we bought new, and a lot of our barrels are used spirit barrels, and we like to buy those because we're in the Midwest. It's relatively easy to get bourbon barrels and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we like to buy them from breweries that have made a spirit. I call them spirit flavored beers. They're, you know, you age a porter in a bourbon barrel and you have bourbon porter or stout or imperial stout or whatever the case may be. So we try to buy the barrels from breweries that do that, and then that way the initial hit of that spirit is taken out and we can, you know, work those into the blend fairly easily. We also have a large number of Firestone Walker barrels. Firestone Walker ferments a portion of at least one of its beers in oak. I think it's one of their pale ales.
Okay.
And so these are barrels that have only been used for fermenting beer, and they're perfect for us. They still have a lot of oak flavor. They've been saturated and soaked with beer for weeks, and they're just ready and primed for the wild yeast to take hold in there. So depending on what beer that we're brewing, we'll use these barrels. We also have some brandy barrels, some wine barrels, as I mentioned. I think we've got a rye whiskey barrel and a couple other random strange barrels in here too. But we reuse these barrels over and over again. So after a number of passes, and it may take years, but after a number of passes, they don't contribute as much. In fact, hardly any at all. Some of them are pretty clean, cleared out of that spirit flavor. We're not really looking for that, and so when we bring in new barrels, we're pretty careful about blending them so that we can minimize that.
One of the things that I was really curious about was how, at least with the year-round beers that you do have, how do you get consistency sort of in the flavors of those beers? Because it seems like, you know, if all the different batches are sort of split up into these different barrels that have different, have been used for aging for different periods of time, it would be all sorts of different flavors going on. How do you get consistency with those beers?
Well, some beers, different beers get consistency through different means, different manners. La Roja is a blended beer, so when we do a bottling run of La Roja, we'll actually sample dozens of different barrels sometimes of different ages, and we'll create a number of different sample blends, always looking for a consistency, something that is La Roja. You know, we want a little bit of sour, we want some caramel, some malt, a little fruit note in there, some spice. You know, some barrels get a real almost cinnamon character. We like to bring in a little bit of that, a little bit of almond or cashew note some of the barrels develop. So we'll sample a number of different barrels, make some notes, do some sample blends, and then blend them all together into the bottling tank, let them sit overnight for the blend to kind of come together, and then bottle the next day. Some of the other beers don't get as intensive a blending. There is a lot of consistency. Even though the barrels tend to develop differently, there still is some consistency in the barrels. So, for example, the Oro tends to always go through the same 16 or 20 different barrels. The BAM beer always tends to go into the same 2,000-liter oak tun.
Okay.
And what we've learned with time is that the beers develop differently. I like to joke, I say it depends on the weather. You know, in the summertime, it's warmer in the brewery, we get more lactic fermentation going on, and the beers will sour more quickly. And in the winter, things might move more slowly. And so depending on the season, we'll know certain beers and certain oak vessels need to move at certain times. They need to be bottled or whatnot. And we sample, too. And so what we'll be looking for with the Oro, for example, which is always through the same group of barrels, is we know at somewhere in the 4 to 6 week range is going to be when we want to bottle that beer.
Okay.
So we develop consistency that way, too.
You kind of mentioned a little about the seasons and different temperatures. Do you try to play some of your seasonal beers off of that just because of the temperatures or because of maybe some of the ingredients that are available to you?
Mostly because of the latter. We try to tie the seasonals in with a season, I guess, but with the type of beer that people might be interested in drinking because of that season, mm-hmm. as well as ingredients. I mean, this in today's world, you can, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your perspective, pretty much buy whatever you want any time of the year, except for hops, mm-hmm. which you can't get any now. But anyway...
Yeah.
So we will try to bring seasonal ingredients into our beers. We have a beer called Fuego de Otoño that we brew for an autumn release. Then we brew that with chestnuts. In the autumn, people start thinking about fall and getting a little wintry and roasting chestnuts and things like that. So it seemed like a good fit there. We do our stout in the wintertime, which is a nice big Belgian-style stout, very robust, lots of different brewing sugars used in that to create a real rich canopy of different caramel flavors and sweet flavors. We release in November, right before the holidays, our Maracaibo, which is brewed with cacao and sweet orange peel, as well as a few other spices. And, you know, there are some varieties of orange that are released, not released, so to speak, but harvested and available that time of year. And so it kind of fits in with that theme as well. So in some senses, we do. We are doing a Roja du Creek right now for the Michigan Brewers Guild Summer Festival, and we have Michigan cherries that are being harvested recently.
Okay, cool.
Have been harvested recently.
And so as far as the ingredients are concerned, you said Michigan cherries, but do you predominantly get domestic ingredients, stuff that's grown closer to home, or do you do a lot of importing to get sort of that Belgian characteristics from the different ingredients?
Well, and that's something that is people kind of come down either way on those sort of issues. I'm all about flavors and finding the right flavor and the perfect flavor. So I know brewers who, you know, use American malt because they want to help the American farmer out, and that's really great. And I use a lot of American malt, but I also use British malt, and I use German malt, and I used a few Belgian malts because I'm looking for specific flavors, and where things are grown really impact the flavor. You know, everybody is aware of it with hops or grape varieties for wine, but even hops, you know, the varieties, European varieties grown in the States taste different and smell different. They're similar, but they have some pronounced differences. And the same is true with barley that's made into malt, as well as the malting traditions of these various nations. So we use a lot of imported malts, a lot of domestic malts as well, some Canadian malts too. So we buy malt from all over the world, and I source other ingredients that way as well. I like to buy local as much as possible. So when we're using something that we can get that's made or grown, I keep saying made, grown in Michigan, that's what we'll do. You know, whether it's cherries or other fruit, Michigan has a lot of fruit that's grown in Michigan. The chestnuts are mostly Michigan chestnuts. But when we're using some other things, for example, I was talking about things grown all around the world. I love Lilikoi passion fruit. The Hawaiian passion fruit is Lilikoi, but I can't buy it here. But I can buy New Zealand passion fruit, and it's different. It's similar, but it's really different. So when we're looking to make these beers, I go for flavor first, and I go for local second. Okay. And I guess, you know, where the chips fall where they may. Our cacao, for example, we buy organic cacao, and that's just not grown here. There's some cacao that's grown in Hawaii, and we're working with those folks and trying to get some of that available. But the growers there are so small, and I mean, even that's not really local, it's just U.S. But the growers are so small right now that it hasn't been practical for them to sell us any. So, you know, if we can't source things locally, we try to buy organic. I buy a lot of organic spices. I think that the flavors in the organics are just far superior to commercially grown flavors. So depending on what we're looking for, you know, we source it all over. You know, it'd be great if somebody made some organic malting quality barley here in Michigan and they had it malted and it tasted phenomenal. I'd buy it for sure.
Okay. One of the other sort of pillars of the of Jolly Pumpkin is the bottle conditioning that you guys do. Mm-hmm. If everyone just talk a little bit about how you package them, and well, the question I sort of had when it said all the beers are bottle conditioned, were if you do any draft beers, how that affects how you package the draft kegs.
We do a little bit of draft. We don't do a whole lot. We mostly do, as you noted, bottle conditioned beers. We also keg condition our beer, which is essentially the same process as bottle conditioning, only it occurs in the keg.
Okay.
We don't have a lot of kegs, and we've lost most of the kegs that we've had. There's a big problem in the country that people are becoming more and more aware of, but keg theft is just, it's huge, and its impact on small brewers is proportionally just ridiculous.
Huh, so, I never heard of that.
You haven't even heard of it.
Well, I heard. I mean, I assume it happened a little bit. I didn't hear that it was such a big problem. I was unaware.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's. I don't. The numbers of kegs that are lost every year is astronomical. You know, the big brewers are losing lots of kegs too.
And for people stealing them for scrap metal, or just to use themselves, or.
Most of the assumptions are that they're selling them for scrap. In many states, the deposit is less than the scrap value. And until really recently, this year there's been some legislation in a few states that has made it illegal to sell kegs unless you can prove you're the owner to a scrapyard. But the scrap value for stainless is very high right now. And so until appropriate deposits can be charged, and in Michigan we're mandated by law to charge a certain deposit. We can't set whatever deposit we want. The replacement value on a keg is, I mean, depending on the quantity, you're going to buy $150, $170, whatever, maybe more, maybe less if you're buying a lot. I don't know. But the deposit just went up for us to $30. It was at $10 a keg. I mean, that's ridiculous. Even $30, it scraps out at over $30. So, we've lost a lot of our keg fleet, probably 2/3 of it over the past 3 years.
Oh, that's terrible.
I haven't been replacing it because it aggravates me and you know, it's expensive. So we do less and less draft every year because of that, and it's keg condition, so it can get pretty carbonated.
Pretty similar flavor to the bottle conditioned.
It's different. Fermentation is an interesting, wonderful, and complex thing, and it's affected by a lot of different dynamics, and the size and shape of the fermentation vessel influence some of the subtleties of the flavor, final flavors of the beer. When breweries upsize and put in larger fermenters, they often have to do a lot of testing to make sure the flavors of the beer is going to be consistent, and whether there's recipe changes or process changes that have to be made. They may make some little tweaks here and there, or sometimes even big changes to maintain a consistent flavor profile just from something like changing a fermentation vessel shape or size.
Huh.
So when you ferment in a bottle, whether it's a 12-ounce bottle or a 750 ml or a keg, you develop subtle differences in the flavor, for sure. So it's the same, but different, if that makes sense.
Huh. Yeah, it does. That's interesting. I thought it that way.
I did not know that.
And when you, when you dispense the keg, we still, even though it's a higher carbonation level sometimes than most draft systems are set up for, it's still not as high as what's in the bottle. And the CO2 also impacts the flavor, gives the beer also other textures by the level of carbonation and the head beer, and all these things are changed when it's served draft. So it's the same beer but different.